I wanted to talk to Andrew Marantz, whose book I like. His book, I mean, I didn't finish it yet, but I'm going to finish it. His book is Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. You can get it now, but it's going to be out in paperback on the 15th of this month, September. And he's been writing for The New Yorker for years. And the evolution of the conversation that we started a year ago with Dale Baran kind of moves into this QAnon thing. And Andrew's been kind of tackling that. So I thought he was the guy to talk to. So this is Andrew Marantz, and we're continuing the conversation. How are you, Andrew?
I'm good. Creating on a curve.
I know. I asked somebody that question, a friend of mine on text, and she said, I'm not great. I'm not horrible. And I said, well, when everything is horrible, it's hard to be great.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so here we are. The conversation has been hijacked.
Yeah.
What started with 4chan and Reddit, and you know, through the minds and eyes of disenfranchised, angry high school males who were then sort of turned out by older, creepy neo-Nazis and then sort of fractioned off into incels, and then sort of that kind of coagulated with Russian troll meme language and the Pepe stuff. And then all of a sudden, I think the big addition to what is becoming this amalgamated mess of propaganda is the infusion of QAnon, but also I think it seems to me to be the realm of radical evangelical Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Is that where we're at? Has everything coagulated? Is there a natural evolution that you see to this QAnon thing?
Yeah, there's definitely an evolution, and so my book came out last year. It actually hasn't even come out in paperback yet. And already, as with all these internet things, some parts of the specifics can start to feel dated. But the underlying systemic forces are exactly the same. So when I was writing about this stuff, it was more in the phase where it was Pizzagate rather than QAnon, right? So it hadn't yet metastasized into this grander thing, which we can talk about. But the underlying systemic forces of how social media works, what it's incentivizing people to do, the kinds of feedback loops it's drawing people into, the system is still working exactly as designed. So a couple of the individual loopholes have been closed.
Designed by who and for what reason?
As designed by the social media companies. So the reason that I call my book antisocial is because the word antisocial applies to the creeps and propagandists and disinformation agents who I hang out with, and I would sit at their side and watch them destroy America, and I would kind of call them and say, hey, you are doing this thing from your laptop in Orange County, California, or in Michigan, or in wherever.
Right.
Can I come sit in your kitchen and watch you destroy America? And they'd say, yeah, right. Sure. And so I would do that. They were the kind of antisocial ones, but it's also antisocial in the sense of, hey guys, social media is doing this to us in a very concerted way.
So the design of social media, the intention was not to destroy America, but you're saying that fundamental to the design of it, the way these loops create by amassing followers around ideology and then by other people sort of, you know, entering it through random tweets or reactions, that the design of it, which was idealistically to bring people together, it's doing that, but in the most malignant way.
Correct. So it's bringing people into these forms of community, and
right.
It's also doing, at the most basic level, what the algorithms are designed to do, which is just to maximize and monetize attention. They're just trying to suck in your attention, get you to stay on the platform for as long as possible. And often it's not even the human beings, but it's the algorithms who are figuring out that if you want to get someone to stay on your platform for 8 or 10 hours a day,
yeah,
actually the best way to do that is to radicalize them to some kind of new cult ideology that they will then sit in their bunker and explore and do all this research.
Yeah,
because,
but again, yeah. So that seems like evil intent. Radicalizing for an ideology in terms of the people that created this stuff would have been more like
right.
around brands.
Right. So the people who created these things are not like, there's going to be this thing called QAnon and everybody's going to get converted
right.
to it. They're just thinking in their techno-utopian way, we're going to put all this freedom out there and we're going to, break down barriers and reduce friction. And that's going to make the world a better place. It's going to bring everyone closer together because they just sort of were operating at this very basic level of, not to be a dick about it, but like Mark Zuckerberg didn't finish college, right? So he never read like sociology and philosophy and history to see how these things could derail. He just learned enough coding and got, you know, enough positive feedback and, you know, frankly, financial rewards for that coding that he thought, oh, coding is the way of the future. The more I can, you know, disintermediate and put power in people's hands, the better it'll be. And there is this basic underlying philosophy that the best stuff will spread and the cream will rise to the top. And then the really dark, gnarly stuff that we're talking about, he obviously, and the people who created this stuff obviously didn't foresee, I'm going to convert everyone to this weird cult that thinks that
But it happened in sort of the kind of fun loving way initially. Mm-hmm. That someone like Zuckerberg would have intended it to happen. Like, you know, like for Pepe to sort of be appropriated and then sort of, you know, repossessed by the alt-right is this kind of funny way of getting kids involved with hate, was sort of like, it's turning it on its head, but that is the inverse of exactly what Zuckerberg and what Twitter guy Jack was thinking of happening, only it was happening for the wrong reasons.
Totally. And it's not like every individual instance of how this can be abused would have been foreseeable. But one of the analogies I sometimes use is, you know, starting a social network is like hosting a big house party. And so you set the conditions that set the vibe of the party. So you're not necessarily responsible for the actions of each individual person, but you decide whether you're carting people at the door. You decide whether you have lighted fire exits. You decide if people are allowed to smoke inside. And if you let people smoke inside, someone else has an asthma attack. And, you know, so you're setting the conditions.
What are you liable for? What are you liable for?
Right. Yeah. And then suddenly 2 billion people are at your party and it's like, oh shit, this has gotten out of hand.
And there's a lot of them that are bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Or who are being conditioned to be bad by the atmosphere of the
party. Okay. So let's then go from that point about radicalization now, because it's happening on different tiers. Like, you know, initially in some of the stuff you covered in your book, you know, you had these kids who were angry and proficient at coding and computers and at hacking and everything else. And they got off on each other's ability to troll and make the most disgusting jokes and try to be as immoral as possible. And that kind of spread into this other ideology. And some of them were radicalized by right-wing thinkers. And then it sort of goes from there. But that is the 4chan Twitter model. But, you know, when you're talking about my dad's generation or boomers, you know, sitting there, you know, not on Twitter, on Facebook and in front of Fox News, that are also, you know, being radicalized, because it just seems like what's happening to them is different, because and we can talk about this. It seems like the incentive of the kids was to fuck with things. Whereas, you know, people of my parents' generation or boomers that are younger than them think they're seeing something relatively objective because of the format.
Oh, totally. Yeah. There are different levels of intentionality and how much people know what is, you know, what is a game and what is reality. And I think where that you were talking before about how these things coagulate and congeal together, one of the things I kept seeing when I would call these people and say, okay, let me sit in your kitchen and watch you do this, they weren't always the 15-year-old, you know, living down the hall from their parents. Sometimes they were, but other times it would be like, I'm a 39-year-old married guy with kids who, you know, goes for a hike in the morning. And then when I come home, I want to, you know, make sure that Hillary Clinton can't become president. And the easiest way for me to do that is to, you know, make up some kind of, you know, viral rumor about how she has Parkinson's or something. And I'm going to, you know, put together these little scraps of evidence that I saw her blinking once. So therefore I'm going to freeze frame that, say she's having a seizure, make that go viral. Then that's going to be recontextualized by the Drudge Report. Then the Drudge Report gets picked up by Fox News. So there are people who are kind of in between complete prankster amateurs and professionals. These are people who actually are kind of getting good enough at reverse hacking news cycles that they not only can make money at it, but they can also like inception things into the mainstream of the news cycle, to the point where I would be hanging out with somebody watching them do that. I would go the next morning and read the newspaper headlines, and I would go, that newspaper headline exists because of what I watched this guy do yesterday.
Wow.
And then it snowballs into this larger grand theory of everything because of all the political energies it's tapping into.
Right. But then you get people like my dad who, like, you know, is sort of like a shallow political moron, you know, regurgitating not even Fox News to me, but the other one, OAN.
OAN. Yeah. That's the new one. Well, this is the thing that I think a lot of times people underestimate. And, you know, I hope that we don't underestimate it again going into 2020, is the degree to which a lot of people don't make decisions based on a well thought out rational analysis of the world. And that's not even like a knock on anyone. It's just a lot of times politics is based on an impression I got of someone.
I don't feel good about that guy.
Yeah. He reminds me of someone I like. Yeah. You know, and like that's how people vote. That's, I think, how a majority of people vote. So this way that we go about doing this political analysis and saying, well, his trade policy is like this and her foreign policy is like this. That's all well and good, but like that's a very outdated model of
sure,
how this stuff works.
Sure, and especially with a generation. What we're finding that ultimately is that most people do it that way.
Yeah.
And generationally speaking, most people are not sophisticated in terms of policy or what it really implies or judicial picks. Mm-hmm. And then you get people like you're talking about. I mean, I guess you were probably talking about Mike Cernovich, you know, before.
Yeah.
You know, and like, but see, these guys, they've got blood on their hands now for what they've unleashed on the world.
Well,
but
then, they knew what they were doing too.
But whether they were pranksters or not, they're not political people. They're fucking hucksters.
Yes.
Right.
Well, you can be a political person and a huckster. Like,
no,
we
have a president. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I get it.
So there are people who, you know, the more I spend time with these people, you know, Cernovich is one. There are others. They go on a spectrum from nihilist, prankster, you know, I just want to fuck shit up, to committed ideological, you know, Nazi, misogynist, whatever. There's a whole spectrum. But what they have in common is that, like you say, they're not great political thinkers. They're not, you know, a lot of them like to think of themselves as like intellectual or, you know, sort of like amateur philosophers. They're not that. What they are is, and when I would write about them for the New Yorker and then again in the book, I would have to reconceptualize, okay, what are these people like? And ultimately what I kept coming back to is they're propagandists, they're media figures. They're all, what they're good at is taking memes in the original sense of memes, the Richard Dawkins sense of the word, and propagating those memes into the bloodstream of the national discourse. That they're actually good at. And it wouldn't have been worth my spending that much time with them if they didn't have that very genuine skill set.
Now, but I guess my question in leading into, like, it seems to me that QAnon has absorbed a lot of the momentum that was the infrastructure was put in place by these guys you were talking about. Now, I don't know whether guys like Milo or Cernovich are dormant or they're done. I don't know, but it doesn't matter because now, like, there's this bigger arcing thing and this mother of all conspiracy theories, which is QAnon, you know, is incorporating, you know, really centuries old conspiracies.
Protocols of the Elders of Zion kind of stuff.
It's such, yeah, like it's all old timey, Freemasony, you know, Protocols of Zion. All this shit has been around for fucking ever.
Yeah.
And now it's sort of been brought together. Now, but when you talk about propagandists in their own right, and maybe they do think that whether it's a mixture of nihilistic fucking with the system or they believe that, you know, on some level they want their guy to win and they believe it ideologically. When you have something like QAnon that absorbs all this stuff, is there a Q? Is there somebody operating this thing on a day-to-day basis that is a – is there an American version of Vladislav Surkov? You know, do we have – I used to think there was that guy with the beard in Trump's orbit was the guy. But is there – so who's guiding this? Because it seems like a fundamentally more than just a Nazi model, it's a Russian model of setting up theatricality, news events, propaganda. It seems like someone's guiding this. Is there?
Yes and no. So there are people. It's not like there is a Surkov or a Goebbels who we know about. I mean, maybe history will reveal that there were people, you know, Bannon likes to claim that mantle sometimes.
Right.
You know, people talk about Stephen Miller. People talk about, you know, Dan Scavino. But I don't think of it, at least as it's unfolding.
Who's the other guy
time
with the beard? He was head of the campaign, Pascal.
Pascal, yeah. So I profiled Pascal for the New Yorker. I actually think that with a lot of those people, Pascal being one of them, the fact that they're actually not that unusual or not that, you know, visionary is kind of an interesting part of the point, that you can just be an average dude.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Pascal is just a guy from Kansas who literally the way he got into the organization was they needed someone to build a cheap website for the Trump real estate business. And he raised his hand from San Antonio and said, I'll do it for $5,000 or whatever. And they were like, we like that.
Oh,
price.
Yeah. I remember reading that about that, that you wrote about him. But I guess I got distracted by the beard and my own projection of insidiousness.
A beard that good can go a long way. But, but yeah, I think that part of why I was, you know, referring to the systems earlier is that if you hitch your wagon to one of those big systems, you don't need to be a bold visionary. You don't need to be a great speechwriter or know how to build an event because the car is already in motion. The car being Facebook or Twitter or Reddit or any of these things, you just kind of have to get in and let it drive.
So, okay. So that there's no, because that becomes a question. I know that Trump's policy or whatever it is, his behavior is being informed by Hannity and some Republican think tanks and a few sort of, more, you know, policy-minded people that, you know, that have charmed him. But in terms of the propaganda that's going on and his sort of kind of, is the word tacit support? Is that the word I want? Of it. It doesn't surprise you, but you're, does it?
No, I think nothing is supposed to surprise us anymore, but.
Right. But like when he sort of gives a little nod to QAnon, you know, like he's just playing to his bleachers.
I mean, I literally think that the way his kind of brand of narcissism works is that literally all he asks is, do these people like me or hate me? Did this person call me a hero or a loser? I think a lot of his worship of Putin, his worship of, you know, name your strongman, is that simple. Like, Putin said a nice thing to me once, therefore I like him. So I think
But they also know he's a fuck. The fundamental of, you know, real strongmen who are willing to kill on purpose and own it know that he's a sucker.
Totally. Right. But he doesn't know that they know that. And I think the QAnon stuff, I think that all he needs to know is, are they on my team or are they on the other team? I mean, it's a completely terrifying form of moral bankruptcy, obviously. If you're anything, I mean, we know he's not going to be good at the job, but even to be inhabiting that seat, you should be able to say, this is a scary, murderous cult and I don't want anything to do with it. And the fact that he's not willing or able to do that, I don't think is unique to this situation. I think it's just, they're on my side. And, well, and I think he also gets at some deeper instinctive level that, as you say, it's tied in with a kind of vibe of millennialist Christianity, that it's tied in with a vibe of kind of feels like proto-white nationalist stuff. And that's all stuff that appeals to him, too.
Right. But it is like essentially a functioning, self-feeding kind of, you know, unprovable mythology that tends towards, you know, Christian end times prophecy and white nationalism.
Well, and at its core, at the simplest level, it's just literally an extension of all the propositions that I was watching those people setting up in 2015, 2016, 2017, and trying to deal with the cognitive dissonance of none of those predictions being able to come true, right? So just at a very basic level, if you're a gung-ho pro-Trump propagandist going into his campaign, and he's saying things like, I'm going to lock Hillary up, I'm going to make America great again, I'm going to bring all the jobs back, just all the, you know, stuff he's saying, none of that stuff is going to happen, right? So if you follow sort of cognitive dissonance theory, which is, you know, this psychology school going back to the 50s of sort of saying, this is what happened with the original cult of Christianity, that, you know, these people are saying Jesus will come back within your lifetime. You can sell all your stuff. You know, you don't need anything because the world's about to end. The longer that goes without happening, the more people double down and proselytize and say, okay, you know, instead of abandoning this ideology, I'm going to do all these kind of psychological loops to try to make it real. And it's the same thing at play here. The more you believe hucksters' lies and con artistry, the more you either have to jump off the train or you have to stay on the train and work even harder to make those things turn true.
So the ability to suspend your disbelief or to believe, like, Christianity in and of itself as a template within the human mind makes this thing possible.
Yeah. Well, and it doesn't even have to be Christianity. But yes, that as a template, or, you know, there are sects of Islam that do this. There's waiting for the Messiah in Judaism. There's also just, you know, living in an abusive relationship with someone who keeps saying they're going to do something nice for you.
Right. But there's also the fundamental belief. And I sort of am of the school of Becker on this from denial of death, that there is almost a genetic compulsion within the human psyche to believe in something bigger than yourself in order to feel like your life is relevant or part of something.
Definitely. You know, there is a need, especially right now, especially, I don't think it's an accident that it's kind of growing during the pandemic and when people's lives are sort of spiraling out of control and when they don't really have any way of finding a sense of purpose, that, you know, and look, this is a basic dynamic that I saw over and over again too, is this notion of the red pill, right? The red pill, as we all know, it's from the Matrix. It's sort of the pill that unlocks the truth. It's the same thing as Alice in Wonderland going down the rabbit hole. It's this ancient, you know, it's Plato and the cave. Yeah, it's this ancient human archetype. But the internet allows you to have this endless series of red pill moments where you go, the scales fall from your eyes and you see the truth. QAnon is like an incredibly labyrinthine, endless cycle of those. So you can always find another puzzle to unlock it.
Okay.
It can be this, yeah.
I get that. I get it. It is the rabbit hole. I understand. Mm-hmm. And it's being fed daily. Mm-hmm. And you can make all sorts of connections throughout the entirety of history. This kind of conspiratorial thinking, reading signs and symbols. How queer does it have to be? Look at this logo. Huh? Huh? That kind of shit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been around a long time. And, you know, and it's very attractive because, you know, it gives people a false sense of intellectualism. It gives them a false sense of history. It gives them closure on things. It serves their ideology. I understand all the reasons why it's appealing to a certain type of mindset, even to somebody like me, but not, you know, I'm not, you know, I know enough about myself to be like, you know what, take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, I see what's happening now, and fanning flames is one thing, but someone's maintaining this thing.
Well, look, in terms of who it was originally, there are different theories. One theory is it was just a joke, and it's like those 4chan guys you're talking about, where they just, all they ever want to do is, you know, mess with people and troll, and, you know, it could have been right. That. It also totally could have been someone who, you know, was sitting around some outer ring of the White House or, you know, some executive agency who said, well, I don't really have that much to do all day because all the president does all day is watch TV and try to shut down government agencies. So I'm going to freelance and create this whole mythology online and see if it goes anywhere. It could have been that. But it also just could have been like one financial incentive that we can track right now pretty directly is that Q, whoever or whatever it is, the person Q can only post originally on 4chan, then on 8chan, then on this thing, 8kun. 8kun is this very endangered website because people keep posting like shooter manifestos on it. So all of the most deranged, radicalized people on the internet, not all of them, unfortunately, but a lot of them congregate around this website. And a lot of them end up being violent maniacs who shoot people in mosques or synagogues or whatever. And every time that happens, this website gets booted offline. The people who run that website, they're these two American guys who live in the Philippines, and they are like, their other businesses are like pig farms and porn, basically. Uh-huh. So they're real wholesome, lovely fellows.
Sort of
and
similar.
Yes, exactly. Pig farms, porn, and conspiracy cults. And there are people who believe, including the guy who founded this site, there are people who believe that the people who are running this site either no Q or RQ, because they have a direct financial incentive to keep.
But these are morally bankrupt people. These are not people that think the best will rise to the top or that eventually it'll play itself out.
Right. So those original sort of techno-utopian elites that we're talking about, yeah, these are very far from that. Those people, like the original sort of techno-utopians, the ones who are paying attention have actually taken a turn now and are trying to have a more nuanced view. So a lot of what I was tracking was how the guys who started Reddit actually turned from that kind of blind techno-utopianism, the cream will rise to the top, to a more nuanced view where they said, actually, we got to get this under control because this has become this feral nightmare. So the 8chan guys are the most morally bankrupt people on the internet. They don't give a shit. They just want to watch it burn and they want to make some money. And so they will do things like, you know, they showed up for congressional testimony wearing a Q lapel pin. Like they're just trying to make money from it. But
how do they make money again? Explain that to me.
Just traffic and ads. So that, and it's a pretty small business. It's not like a, you know, billion-dollar business. But the people like the Reddit people and to some extent the Twitter people, they are trying to go, okay, well, we're not going to totally abandon the idealism that we started this with, but we're no longer going to do this complete laissez-faire, you know, free speech above all.
Right.
We're going to start to say like, okay, if there are people who are going to try to incite violence, like the guys who started Reddit actually they went to the University of Virginia, which is in Charlottesville. And so I was talking to them right after the Charlottesville thing happened. Mm. And they were like, oh shit, that's our town. That's our alma mater. The people who organized this white supremacist march were doing it in part on our thing that we made up in our dorm room at the University of Virginia. And then they let me sit in the room and watch them as they deleted all these Nazi subreddits, which they never would have done in the early days. They never would have done it and they never would have let me watch. But they had realized they'd kind of grown up from the 22-year-olds who were like, free speech, anything goes, and it'll figure itself out. The marketplace of ideas will sort it out, to evolve to this other place where they were like, okay, we have to be the bosses here.
But you know, it's interesting is those kind of people still exist, these free speech kind of like laissez-faire attitude people, but they don't seem to realize that, you know, if they let their sort of not utopian concepts, but what they're seeing as constitutional concepts just go unregulated, they're going to be killed by the people that they've created.
Yeah, I don't get, you know, I, you know, I like, get how this...
What does Ben Shapiro think he fucking is?
Exactly. So the thing that's weird about slippery slope thinking is that everyone can only kind of do one slippery slope at a time. Like, you hear the slippery slope argument of, if we shut down this person's speech, who's next? What if we shut down someone else's speech? I get that. I think that's legit. Lenny Bruce, you know, got arrested for obscenity. Like, I get all that. But where's the slippery slope argument that goes, if we let the Nazis march around with guns, what's going to happen if the Nazis get too much power? Like, shouldn't we be worried about that slippery slope argument? Because
right.
I just, if you're going to be paranoid about one thing, at least be paranoid about all of it.
No, for sure. And I just don't, you know, I it's that kind of stuff, without getting off on a tangent, it's very hard to understand whatever the fuck is wrong with Stephen Miller. He's a Jew, man. And
Jew from Santa Monica.
Yeah, I know. And does he think he's going to get a pass when the shit goes down? I don't even.
I do have to say, I've talked to some pretty hardcore Nazi propagandists, and not old school Nazis, but like the new Nazis, the alt-right, sort of in league with Richard Spencer types. And watching their minds explode when I bring up Stephen Miller is so interesting, because it's very core to their ideology that the Jews are the central problem,
right?
That if we could just name and get rid of the Jew. And I'm like, seems like a Jew is running your shit, guys. And they're like, we don't know what to do with that information. It does not compute.
Really? They don't know what to say? They've not said anything on it to you in any specific
way? They will say, you know what, that one really confuses us. Like, he really seems to be on our team. And we don't know.
So you're telling me that Stephen Miller might be the Jew's only hope?
He's the one. He's the one who can get through the door. I mean, these are, I mean, he was friends with Richard Spencer in college. Like, it's not that many degrees of separation.
That's a pathology we're dealing with. And, you know, his timing in history is something, but there's something a little screwy up there.
Well, it's related to the other pathologies we're talking about. This notion of sort of contrarianism and kind of this addiction to kind of being pugilistically engaged with the world.
Right.
You know, there are people who get into stuff like Pizzagate or QAnon or whatever because it's just kind of a video game and they're kind of just exploring it. There are other people who get into it because they're like, the only narrative that can be true is the narrative that the institutions don't want me to believe, that society doesn't want me to believe, that my parents don't want me to believe, that my children don't want me to believe.
The bat. I want a bat.
Yeah. I want something to go to war with, and I want something to make me feel unique and special. And like you said, it's not that hard to relate to that basic impulse of like, I have this thing that no one else knows about. And, you know, you talk to some of these people. What's really interesting is when you talk to people who've been all the way down the rabbit hole and then come out the other side, but who still remember what it's like. And they will tell you, like,
how often does that happen?
Less than you want it to. But there are a few people. There's this woman who I spent a lot of time with who was way high up. They called her the first lady of the alt-right. She was like helping to plan the Charlottesville riots. And she was, she like got David Duke a hotel room with her credit card and all this stuff.
Uh-huh.
She made it out. And when she first met me, she was like, her brain was so scrambled that she was like, I know the Holocaust definitely happened, but like, was it 6 million though? Do we really know how many it was? Was it maybe like 1,000? I was like, no, I think they really know. Like, I think they've done the research. And she was like, yeah, I know, but I did it really though. Like, her brain had just been fried from this immersion in this world.
Wow. So you're saying, like, because, yeah, oddly, when I was a kid, it was 10 million. And at some point they made a concession. I don't know why. Yeah. When I went to synagogue, it was 10. And then it was like, it was probably more like 6. And we're like, well, okay. But yeah.
It's called making a deal.
Yeah. I don't know who with. But so that's the question. Like, so when these people get radicalized, you know, whether they signed up for it or not, even people like my father, you know, after a certain point, there is no return, kind of.
Yeah. For some people, it's really hard to get out because you've burned some bridges. You've like put some stakes in the ground. And
in your world, you've burned bridges.
In your world, you've said, like, you're all going to be, I'll get the last laugh. You're going to see. I mean, you know, going back to the Christianity thing, this is like, there are preachers every so often who will literally predict the end of days. and they'll say it's going to be October 22nd, 1844. Like, I actually, this is before any of this, like 10 years ago or something, I did a piece where, do you remember, I think it was 2011, where there was a guy who like took out billboards in Times Square and was like, May 24th, 2011, that's the day.
Yeah.
And so I went to Times Square because I'm like a reporter and I'm curious about this stuff. And I picked someone out of the crowd and said, what are you doing on that day? Can I be with you? And he was like, yeah, he was like a firefighter from Long Island. He was like, yeah, you can watch me get sucked up into the sky in a tornado. So I went to his house in Hicksville, Long Island.
Yeah.
And it's like funny, but also like he had a 4-year-old daughter and he was like, okay, honey, when this happens, you're going to want to walk out to the backyard. We're going to stand together. And his wife was like, I swear to God, once today is over, you better never bring this shit up again. Like she was not a believer.
Right.
And so I stayed with him until like the time passed. Like he was literally, he called and ordered a pizza and he literally said to the guy, could you please hurry? Like, it's coming.
Huh.
And then I watched him as the time passed, and he was kind of doing some quick math of like, maybe I got the wrong time zone. Maybe it's happening in the Hawaii time zone. And then by midnight, he was just like, I don't know what to do. He just like stopped texting me, and I, you know, just made sure with his wife that he was okay. And she said, yeah, he's okay. But like, how do you come back from that? How do you go back to your buddies at the fire station and say like, whoops, sorry, guys?
Well, ultimately, if enough time goes by, you know, they're like, that was weird, right? You okay?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not the same as, like, telling them, you know, that Jews are terrible and that,
Or that everyone in the government is a child-eating pedophile.
Right, and we should kill all the Mexicans.
Right, right.
I mean, it's a little different. The guy just had, like, yeah, he had a dream. It didn't happen. Now he's back, you know.
Right, right. But there is a lot of pride wrapped up in it. And if you build your identity around...
That's the fucking problem.
Yeah.
It's that fucking, that pride. Is that, like, you know, you can't admit you're wrong after a certain point until something horrible happens. But how horrible?
It's your identity. Like if you're, you know, the media told, like even at the, look at something as simple as how much, how many YouTube compilations there are of the media getting the 2016 election wrong. There's just this feeling of like, we knew this was going to happen and you motherfuckers in the media, you got it wrong. That feeling can just be extended to anything.
Sure. So and then, and also like there's, if you're proficient in formats, you know, everything looks like official. Everything looks like news. And people, I don't hear that talked about as much as it should be really, is that anybody can make a pretty professional looking thing. And I,
well, this is the key when I was talking about these amateur / professional propagandists. That's what makes someone be able to transition from amateur to professional. Cause you can register a website, you can make a Facebook thing, you can get it into as far propelled into the mainstream of the discourse as you want. That's why I sometimes get hung up on this semantic thing when people say fringe. I'm like, I don't know that this stuff is fringe because you can get it into the mainstream of the news cycle within 5 minutes if you're good at it.
Well, yeah, it's a content hungry news cycle that spans the planet.
Yeah. There are people who, I mean, the people who were good at it, they would show me, okay, this is how I'm going to get this to trend on Twitter, or this is how I'm going to get Sean Hannity to mention this, or this is how I'm going to get, you know, this to become a Drudge headline or whatever.
That's
and then
so
they would
weird.
Break it down, reverse engineer it, and just, you would watch them do it. And this is what I mean sort of specifically when I say that this is the system working as designed. The people who founded these things did not know what the content was going to be. To some extent, they were agnostic as to what the content was going to be. But if you had told them, like, your trending algorithm will be just habitually gamed, and not just by foreign actors or whatever, or spies or agents, but by just like people using the system well, I think if you could go back in a time machine and tell them that, hopefully they would have a little bit of pause and go like, okay, we thought we were building this system that was going to be a heat map of conversations and what people were interested in. But the fact that it could be gamed by anyone at any time, just through these outrage mobs and just through, and it's not even that hard. It just means that, you know, one of the sort of refrains that I keep coming back to is this philosopher, Richard Rorty, who has this whole concept of contingency, irony, and solidarity. And that because things are contingent, the story of history has not yet finished being written. It can go any way. And so you have to change how we talk is to change who we are. What we talk about, what we value, who we are as a society, that's always up for grabs. So then you put that sort of underlying philosophy together with the notion that how we talk is we talk to each other through these internet boxes that are all manipulated according to heat cycles and outrage mobs and clickbait and manipulating our emotions. it's not a good thing. If how we talk is who we are, and how we talk is through these broken slot machines of generated emotion and excitement and manufactured engagement, it's very hard to see how that dynamic gets broken.
Not only the dynamic, but it's really, you know, it's not who anybody is. It's really kind of a kind of brain fucking technology that holds people hostage and uses them as puppets. It's a trance almost.
Oh yes, it's preying on, and this is why, you know, when people try to make the point that these are businesses like any other business, I think to some extent that's right and to some extent it's wrong. But I think at a basic level, it's like, if what you do is sell food and then somebody comes along and tells you that high fructose corn syrup is killing people, you go, well, I'm still in the food business, right? So until someone comes along and shuts me down, I'm going to keep selling this food, right?
Yeah. And people like it.
People like it. Watch. They'll get their revealed preferences. They keep buying it, right?
Yeah.
So what are you going to come in and tell me I don't have the freedom to give people what they want?
There's the argument against the cream rising and also the argument against free market capitalism.
Yeah. It's very tied up in the free market stuff. We've been in this sort of spell of the last 40 years of saying, well, if people didn't like it, they wouldn't buy it. Yeah. If it weren't a good product, it wouldn't be doing well. You know, it's all this like self-regulating thing. It's this Milton Friedman thing. It doesn't work like that. And that's, you can see it directly in this metaphor of the marketplace of ideas, right? The market has spoken.
So, all right. So now let's wrap it up by thinking about, cause I don't know what Jaron Lanier said, but the idea has been put in my head. And it seems like we're talking about that the interplay between human psychology and social media platforms is fundamentally changing humanity mm-hmm. and the human brain, right? Yeah. And
yes.
in specific ways through this algorithm and this sort of self-feeding thing, how is it changing the human brain specifically in your mind?
Well, so at a, you know, the most basic thing that these platforms are doing is targeting and manipulating what social scientists call activating emotions. So the fundamental thing about the algorithm is whatever makes you feel not only the most emotions, but these specific kinds of emotions, and you can list them out. Those are the things that win. So again, this gives the lie to this notion that the cream rises, because they've built it in such a way. It's like building a slot machine, and you go, okay, people respond to colors. People respond to this kind of noise. It happens in this pattern. You know, if you vary up the pattern, people are like lab rats.
And also,
they respond
better to it. You can specifically manipulate people based on their choices.
Yeah, that's micro-targeting. So people who, you know, buy milk on Thursdays and drive this kind of car and,
right.
you know, whatever, are and it's all correlation. It's not like you're psychic and you're looking into their brain. It's just you have a big enough sample size, and so you know what the patterns are.
Right.
There's also a technique that I sort of, I don't know if I made this up or whatever, but I call it macro-targeting. That is, so there's micro-targeting, which is cutting the population into these little slivers, like retired military moms who like paintball or whatever.
Right.
There's also macro targeting, which is it works on everyone. Anger works on everyone. Fear works on everyone. Disgust works on everyone. Loathing. So these are things that, you know, and people will say to me, oh, you know, you call the book antisocial. You're always talking about the negative side of these things. You're so down on social media. What about all the positive things? What about Black Lives Matter? What about Me Too and all this stuff? And I think the point is that stuff is very real. And there really are movements in human history that would not have happened or would not have happened as easily if not for the internet.
Yeah.
But I think what's crucial to remember is that these activating emotions that these algorithms prey on, there are positive activating emotions, but the ones that are easier to prey on are the negative ones.
Well, it's interesting because disgust, loathing, anger, fear, that, you know, that to give those all voice and relief is actually, you know, that's actually Pepe's catchphrase. It feels good, man. Feels good, man.
I know. Well, this is why these things tend to curdle. I mean, this is the Jaron Lanier argument, is that you can start out as the positive emotional side of the ledger, and it tends to curdle over time the more it gets caught up in the gears of the internet because, you know,
because you're being played.
You're being played, yeah. And the algorithms lift up certain things and downgrade other things.
But QAnon, so what we're establishing is that it's a self-feeding monster that people can engage in and passionately and create little subgroups around it in reality, you know, or online. It seems to be going both places. It encompasses a lot of white supremacist thinking, a lot of racist thinking, a lot of conspiratorial thinking. But I guess the question is, it's, as we've established here, is it's not fringe. It is mainstream. It is dangerous. And it's not going away. So where do you think this takes us?
Yeah, it's not. We should be clear. People have been killed over this. A train has been derailed in California by someone who's a believer in this cult. It's definitely dangerous. And also in terms of it not being fringe, not only did the president not rebuke it, as you said, but there are multiple people now who are confirmed self-admitted QAnon believers
who are campaigning on it, running
for Congress, and at least one of them will almost certainly be in Congress. So, like, it's not just like, oh, there's this crazy offensive belief system
like
it's
it,
that
like it used to be back in the
like
day.
It used, right,
like,
but
it's like the LaRouches or, you know,
yes, yeah. Like the LaRouches or like, you know, the Dixiecrats or whatever, but like these are people who go around saying like Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are like trafficking children and harvesting their adrenal glands, and they're like functioning Satanists, and like they're sending secret messages to the children to try to indoctrinate them. And those are going to be their colleagues. It's kind of like the best you can hope for is that they're just saying it cynically to get elected because they know.
Oh God, I hope so. But I feel like there's the minority.
Yeah, totally. No. And these things, it's like these things can get embedded into our politics. I think it's hard to see now because this stuff is so lurid and so freakish and so vivid that it's like it has to be fringe because it's so crazy that, you know, we have this sort of natural impulse in the kind of like, you know, descended from Enlightenment values corner of the universe to say things will kind of self-correct, you know, the freakish and bizarre and anomalous will not stay.
The cream will rise to the top.
Exactly, exactly. That is like the intellectual galaxy brain version of that. And as you are saying, it's in itself bullshit because, you know, these things, like, this is what people were saying about birtherism. This is so insane. This is so fringe. This is so freakish. And now, like, birtherism has the presidency and multiple members of Congress, and we just don't notice it anymore.
Yeah, people want to like believe too. They just want.
Yeah, it's like what happens with the pandemic or whatever. You have this horrific freak show happening day after day, and then you just get habituated to it and go like, "Oh, it happened again today."
Right. Yeah. And until that's just what we're living in. It's not happening today. It's not normalized. It is reality. These people now run things.
Right.
And the woke people, the Winston Smiths of the world, it's only a matter of time before they get hammered into believing.
Yeah, right. This is why I do think that I make room for a certain amount of like repetitive hysteria in my own world where I'm like, it's okay to constantly be saying what is happening. This isn't normal because it's better than the alternative where you just accept it.
Of course. But it is a weird fight and a weird struggle. And the more you talk to who you think are like-minded people, what really becomes revealed in the face of this is not that your friends are going in a direction you don't necessarily know or understand. It's that most people are fucking shallow and they don't know, you know, how to focus on information that will keep them sort of, you know, engaged in the proper narrative around this.
Well, this is the thing. I think that most people are empty inside in like a profound way and almost in like a Buddhist way. Like there is just a kind of like bubble of empty air at the core of people that, you know, the woman I was referring to who became a Holocaust denier and sort of rose up through the ranks of this white identity movement.
Right.
She was, and this happened to a lot of the people I spoke to. She grew up in New Jersey, had a lot of multiracial friends growing up. It's never the cartoon of the, you know, trailer park, whatever that people want it to be.
Yeah.
It's her family was, you know, not a broken home, whatever, like all the stuff. And then I followed her through this whole, you know, talked to her for dozens and dozens of hours, got to know her really well, still in touch with her. And at the end of all of it, she kept asking me, like, you know me in a way better than I know myself. What is your assessment of me? Am I just a bad person? Am I a monster? Did I have hate in my heart? And to my mind, I was like, I just think that's the wrong question. I think the issue is that there's this emptiness at the core of a lot of our decision making and a lot of our thinking, where we don't go, oh, now I can tear my mask off and reveal that I've always hated Jews and Black people. But it's just like, when I was in high school, people were doing the Obama thing, so I did that. And now I ended up through these bizarre set of life circumstances meeting a guy, and he led me toward this other group of people, and I was in love with him, so I went along with it, and now I'm a Nazi. And like, yeah, that's a
codependency problem. She should probably go to an Al-Anon meeting.
Yes, for sure. There's that. But you know, everyone has that set of personal issues that can lead them down these alleys.
They
and
don't have a functioning set of personal principles that were sort of forged, you know, from their heart.
Yeah. And the thing is, I think that what we mean by principles and what we mean by like consistent beliefs is often a little bit more of a chimera than we would like to believe. Like, I think a lot of it is contingent on the fact that everyone else around us is doing some version of us too, some version of that too.
Right.
And that's ultimately why I really worry about changing how we talk, then in turn changing who we are. Because if everyone around you is saying this is what isn't the new normal, some large percentage of people are going to go along with that.
Right. And it's sort of like, you know, Burroughs, I think once sort of, I don't know what the context was, but he said that the human brain is really a fairly simple and recording device.
Yeah.
Because that'll get you to that nothingness pretty quickly.
Yeah. And then you wake up one day and you're shooting your wife, you know, you never know.
Yeah. Well, that's a great way to end. And
gotta always go out on a high note with this stuff.
Thanks for talking to me, Andrew. It's great meeting you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.